From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, Ukraine is rocked by protests as tens of thousands take to the streets in condemnation over their government's anti-EU stance.
Police cleared the main square very forcibly using truncheons and beating and causing a lot of injuries.
We tell you the good, the bad and the ugly over the latest healthcare.gov saga. We're in Nigeria to hear why extremist group Boko Haram are still bringing bloodshed and chaos to the region. And also today, why drone delivery may not take off quite as smoothly as the CEO of Amazon suggests.
These generations of vehicles, it could be a 10-mile radius from a fulfillment center. So in urban areas, it could actually cover very significant portions of the population.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. United Nations investigators have implicated Syria's highest-level officials, including President Bashar al-Assad, in war crimes and crimes against humanity. Syria's deputy foreign minister quickly countered the accusations, calling them nonsense. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has arrived in Japan on a six-day trip that also includes stops in South Korea and China. Priscilla Huff has more.
From a White House statement, the official purpose of U.S. Vice President Joe Biden's Asia trip is to reaffirm America's enduring presence as a Pacific power and to underscore the commitment to rebalancing U.S. foreign policy towards the Asia-Pacific. But with China asserting its authority over the Senkaku Islands, also claimed by Japan, U.S. officials are privately saying their top concern is whether a small incident could rapidly worsen already rocky relations. That's in large part due to the White House perception that China opposes the Obama administration's pivot to Asia and wants to push American influence back out into the Pacific Ocean.
Amazon, the world's largest online delivery company, is testing unmanned drones to deliver goods to customers in its latest bid to improve efficiency. Chief Executive Officer Jeff Bezos told Network CBS that the delivery gadgets called octocopters can carry up to 5 pounds for half an hour's flying time within 5 years. Nina Maria Potts reports.
In an increasingly competitive online delivery industry, world giant Amazon relies on speed, price, and customer service, which is why CEO Jeff Bezos says the company is developing innovative technology to keep ahead of the game. In an interview to CBS's 60 Minutes, the e-commerce business leader said delivery drones could be operational within 5 years, pending the approval of U.S. regulators.
This is still years away. Drops the package.
There's the package.
You come and get your package. And we can do half-hour delivery.
The use of unmanned drones in the U.S. has caused heated debate, but civilian airspace is expected to be opened up to a wide variety of drones by 2015.
New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo says he believes speed was a factor in the train derailment that killed 4 people and left dozens injured on Sunday. He says there are a number of lines of investigation, including possible human error. Nick Harper has the details.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo returned to the scene of the accident on Tuesday morning, 24 hours after the train derailed just outside New York City. Speaking to NBC's Today Show, Cuomo said speed could have been the reason for the crash. The investigation will center on 3 lines of inquiry: track problems, equipment problems, or simple human error. An engineer on the train is reported to have told investigators he applied the brakes, but they didn't seem to fully work.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Several hundreds of people were injured in clashes between the opposition and riot police in central Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets protesting against the Ukrainian president's decision to withdraw from an association deal with Europe. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
The city authorities said some 300 people were injured in clashes after a massive anti-government demonstration in Kyiv at the weekend turned violent. 42 were taken to hospitals. According to Kyiv officials, among the injured were some 40 journalists and more than 50 police officers. Hundreds of thousands of protesters marched through the city demanding the government sign a trade and association agreement with the European Union. Some demonstrators attempted to storm the country's presidential administration. They reportedly used a building excavator to try and break through police lines protecting the government building. Hundreds of pro-European opposition activists spent the night on barricades demanding the president step down. Opposition leaders are calling for a nationwide strike. The Ukrainian parliament's speaker Volodymyr Rybak said talks between the government and the opposition should be held shortly.
And the result of last week's presidential election in Honduras is creating controversy in the country, as thousands are protesting the outcome. On Sunday, defeated left-wing presidential candidate Xiomara Castro led supporters in a protest along the streets of the capital, Tegucigalpa. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
Juan Orlando Hernández, the conservative candidate of the ruling National Party, was declared the winner of Honduran presidential elections. But Xiomara Castro says there was election fraud, robbing her of the presidency. The Honduras Electoral Court declared Hernández the winner after counting 99% of the ballots, 37% of which had been casted in favor of Hernández, leaving Castro in second place with 29% of the votes. Castro and her husband, ex-president Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted by a coup in 2009, led the protest.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Ukraine, the vast European nation roughly the size of Texas, is in the grip of ongoing protests. The capital, Kiev, has seen tens of thousands take to the city centre, with activists storming council buildings and blocking government offices. The demonstrations are in reaction to the country's president, Viktor Yanukovych's refusal to support a deal for stronger EU ties. Yanukovych claims he'd come under pressure from Moscow not to sign the EU trade pact. Earlier, I spoke to Ukraine-based journalist David Stern.
Well, the protests continue. It's quieter now. It's not to say that it's quiet, but it's obviously quieter now than it was on Sunday when we had these major clashes between police and the protesters. At the moment, there are about 20,000 people on the main square, but that is filling up. The president has had a conversation apparently with the European Union leaders, and he has promised to look into or investigate officially the violence that sort of sparked these protests when police cleared the main square very forcibly using truncheons and beating and causing a lot of injuries. And he also said that he was going to send a delegation to Brussels to reopen or to discuss some aspects of this trade agreement that he had put on hold, that was which the protesters are demanding that it be signed. This is what started this whole thing off, when Ukraine said that it was not going to sign a major agreement with the EU.
And in regard to that EU trade deal, what role is Moscow playing in this protest?
Well, Moscow is playing a role in the protest, in that the protesters don't want to move closer to Russia. That's one of the main things that you hear on the street. It's not just a question of moving closer to the EU or to Europe or becoming more of a European country or integrating with Europe or whatever they want to say about it, but they also say that we do not want to move closer to Russia. Now, it should be said there are a number of people in Ukraine that feel otherwise. How many, it's not clear, but there are the base of President Yanukovych's support is in the east. It's much more Russia-friendly there. It's less enthusiastic about the EU, and so they feel they don't feel as strongly about better relations with Russia. Also, Russia applied a great deal of pressure before Mr. Yanukovych decided to halt or to suspend this EU agreement or the signing of the agreement. They threatened, they introduced some trade sanctions, and they threatened even more. And so Ukraine was forced to reconsider it. They said they couldn't afford it economically. They said that their economy was already in bad enough condition, and they needed to look after their major trading partner, which was Russia.
A popular, well-known, and quite striking figure in Ukraine politics is former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. What part does her story play in these demonstrations?
Well, she's in jail, and that she's been in jail for the last 2 years. She was handed down a 7-year jail sentence for on charges of abuse of power. the West, European leaders, as well as the United States, saw that as politically motivated. She's a political prisoner. And they had demanded her release as a precondition for signing this agreement. She is a factor in these protests. She's not one of the main causes, main being obviously the question of European integration and moving closer to Russia. But she is definitely on many people's minds.
And finally, as someone who has covered extensively the politics of Russia and the former Soviet Union, where do you see this particular demonstration heading?
Well, that's, you know, the $60 million question. The protesters are leading this this movement. It's not so much a political. It's not being led so much by the political leaders. They say they're going to stay on the street until their demands are met. Now, obviously, there are a lot of different demands. The political leaders are demanding that President Yanukovych resign, that they have a new government, and that there are also new parliamentary elections, in addition to the signing of the agreement. We've seen this before. Ukraine had a orange revolution at this exact time of the year, 9 years ago. People, it's cold out on the streets, just as it was back in 2004, and people have shown that they're able to live on the street for weeks at a time if they feel so motivated, if they really believe in what they're protesting for.
David Stern in Ukraine. This is FSN Reports. The White House says it's going to sponsor a series of events in the next few weeks to promote the Affordable Care Act, after Obama administration officials said the website, healthcare.gov, is finally running smoothly. They've conceded that it still requires some additional technical fixes, but 2 months after the president's signature reforms came into force, the website can now handle 50,000 simultaneous users and up to 800,000 total users in any given day. FSN's Simon Mark spoke to Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report, and asked her whether the White House is now out of the healthcare woods.
Well, yes, I would say that things are working better, but they're not just fine. And folks in the White House, all the way up to the president, acknowledged that things were not going to be 100% by December 1st, but they say that, well, they're not as bad as they were on October 1st. As you know, however, the media is going to continue to follow the ups and downs of the website until there are no longer shutdowns or meltdowns or problems.
Now, the administration has said throughout this experience that the website was only one way in which people could sign up for what the Republicans call Obamacare. You could pick up the phone, you could fill out forms and use snail mail. But do we have a sense yet of how much has been lost as a result of the snafus that have tied this system up in knots since its launch?
Well, we'll talk about it in an existential way first, and then we'll talk in a more practical way. In the more existential manner, what has been lost is significant and difficult to get back, and that's the trust of the American public. The president's approval rating has dropped down now to the low 40s. He's at historic lows in terms of voters' feelings of trust in him and his ability to steer the government, to be in charge of the government. Those are hard numbers to get back, even if the website is fixed. The first impression is that it was disastrous, and there are going to be concerns among voters, I think, for some time that there may still be bumps in the ointment. So I think that's a big piece of it. The other existential piece of this is the fact that the website has always been only one piece of the puzzle here. Remember, come January 1st, a whole lot of people are going to have to get used to a new healthcare system. These are people that heard the president tell them that if they liked their healthcare, they could keep it. Well, if you're a senior on Medicare Advantage, if you're a small business owner, if you are somebody getting individual insurance, you may likely see a change in your health care plan. So that still has yet to hit.
And what is your sense, Amy, of where Democrats in Congress now stand on this issue? They were, last time we spoke, putting enormous pressure on the White House. Do you think that's been alleviated by the events of the last few days?
Listen, I think that they have been able to make the case that they are pushing the president forward. They have been offering their own amendments to try to at least, if not alleviate concerns of their constituents, to show them that they are trying to do something about this. But when push comes to shove, ultimately, Democrats are tied to the president and perceptions of the president. If his approval rating is around 40%, there's very little that a Democrat can do to try and detach himself or herself from the president's standing. That is just the reality of American politics. Regardless of how well the website works, there are still going to be plenty of stories written in 2014 about individuals whose health care options have changed and changed in a negative way.
Simon Mark speaking to Amy Walter from the Cook Political Report. Now, for many, the beginning of December might signal the start of the holiday season, but here in the US, it's also the start of AIDS Awareness Month. It all began with World AIDS Day on Sunday, and this year, the event's been surrounded by a wave of positivity, thanks to new advances in research and more progress than ever in battling the disease. But this World AIDS Day hasn't just been about looking back, it's also looking to the future, as experts say it's now looking genuinely possible to cut HIV down to a low-level epidemic. Lorna Shaddock's been finding out more.
Excited applause among a room full of scientists, philanthropists and politicians at a think tank in Washington, D.C., all with one clear goal in mind: ending the AIDS epidemic. There's a lot of positivity in the air at the start of this year's AIDS Awareness Month. New HIV infections are declining globally. A study released last week by the One Campaign suggests that if current rates of progress continue, the world will reach the beginning of the end of AIDS as early as 2015. Treatments by PEPFAR, the AIDS Prevention Fund set up by George W. Bush, mean that more than 5 million HIV-positive people are now working, studying, teaching, learning and otherwise contributing to their communities when once they would have been dead or dying. Rwanda's First Lady, Jeanette Kagame, was keen to point out the evidence of such progress in her own country.
New HIV infections have been reduced by 50% in the last decade. Mortality associated with HIV fell by almost 80%.
Mark Dybul, chief executive of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, also emphasized how far things have come.
You know, when all this started 10, 12 years ago, what leaders in Rwanda and Nigeria and all over Africa and all over the world were doing is stopping death. They were just ending the massive amount of death that was occurring in their countries and in their villages and devastating their communities. And that's extraordinary. That's the world's a different place. Their countries are different places because of that.
But he's also warning that those in the forefront of the battle against HIV and AIDS can't rest on their laurels. There's a big goal that's now looking attainable.
It's not just looking back at all the results. It's actually looking forward at what's possible. And because of scientific advance, because of our epidemiological understanding, which is very refined now, really, for the first time in history, we can actually see how we can end HIV as epidemics. Doesn't mean there won't be cases of the disease, but it'll be at such low levels they won't be public health threats. So it's a truly historic moment, and one we need to grab hold of and seize.
Mr. Dybul says new evidence and data means that global healthcare experts can laser guide the right treatments to the right populations. New mapping suggests HIV is now being pushed into concentrated pockets amid a sea of much lower levels of infection worldwide. It's people marginalised by society, sex workers, drug addicts, prisoners, who tend to live in those pockets. And, he says, it's those people who need to be reached if the goal of turning the pandemic into a low-level epidemic is to be attained. If they are, computer modelling shows that there could be as much as a 70% reduction in new infections by 2029. And the goal is worth it, as Jeanette Kagame reminded her audience in Washington.
I was going to ask the question, what if we didn't care? But I shudder just imagining what the cost of inaction and indifference would be. We don't want to imagine a resurgence of the virus. Who wouldn't wish to reach out to an HIV-positive mother and save her baby? who wouldn't wish to reach out to an orphan of HIV and protect her from poverty. We do not want to be thrown back into the pandemonium of 15 years ago when people were dying every minute and we were powerless.
For Mrs. Kagame in Africa, the consequences of not caring have already been made painfully obvious. But the consequences of continuing to care, thanks to new scientific breakthroughs, appear to be a tantalizing prize worth fighting for. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
And we can do half-hour delivery.
Half-hour delivery.
Half-hour delivery. And we can carry objects, we think, up to 5 pounds, which covers 86% of the items that we deliver.
Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos on CBS's 60 Minutes, claiming that the company is working on using automated drones to deliver customer goods. Amazon has announced plans to begin offering a drone delivery service in the next 4 to 5 years, if approved by the FAA. In the US, the company still has a number of regulatory and technological hurdles to overcome. Earlier, FSN's Rebecca Hume spoke to Mary Cummings, a drone expert and associate professor of aeronautics and astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
I've been saying for years, and in fact I was on The Daily Show about a year ago talking about cargo. There's no question that it can be done. I think the real question is the scale.
Obviously, Amazon's doing this because they want to sort of boost efficiency of their service. I mean, is this something they can roll out on a big scale and actually make efficient and quite, you know, effective for them?
Well, it won't be their only mode of delivery in the future. There's some just basic limitations. First of all, distance. I mean, they've even said that they can't really go more than 10 miles. And I would say, depending on the size of the aircraft, that's really going to limit how far they can go and the weather conditions, right? So these aircraft are not going to be good in high wind conditions, high gusty winds, and certainly not good in snow and sleet. And so there's definitely, they're not all-weather aircraft either, so there will be conditions in which these aircraft couldn't make deliveries. But, you know, they could actually do pretty well at night. In fact, they would be, that's probably when you would see a lot of this happen. They would be kind of like take the FedEx business model and do most of the deliveries at night, because that actually introduces a new layer of security.
Now, just talking about security, what are the risks here in terms of security? And is the FAA likely to allow this to go ahead?
Well, I wouldn't confuse security with just a psychological readiness. I would say the U.S. market may not be ready for drone delivery, really more from a psychological aspect than any kind of security aspect. I suspect, actually, that we will see Amazon take this to a commercial market in other countries before it comes to the U.S., and that's primarily because of regulatory apathy. I mean, I think the FAA doesn't want this to happen, and they've been very slow to get UAVs introduced into the commercial market, even though there's been a congressional mandate to do so. So I think that we will get there in the United States, but I think other countries will get there ahead of us.
I mean, how many years away do you think we are from this in the U.S.?
About 5, if not 5 to 10. There's just a lot of little details that have to be worked out. And I think that you would see more of a gradual approach than all of a sudden you'll see drones delivering packages to your doorstep. I suspect something like drones to a delivery safe place would happen first, before they would transition to, to being able to deliver to any doorstep. But we'll see, because it's really anybody's guess right now, since the FAA has no regulations in place yet that would drive all this.
Is it a logical move?
Sure. If you actually think about the cost savings, I mean, first of all, you don't have to invest in all the ground transportation, which are the vehicles and the gas and the people and the delays. I mean, you really do cut out several middlemen by going straight from an Amazon warehouse to people who live nearby. So there's no question there's a business case to be made, and certainly customer loyalty and happiness with the product. You know, I would be so thrilled if I could have my product in minutes to hours instead of days, right? So I think there is a business case here, but like I said before, it would never be their only mode of delivery. It won't be their primary mode of delivery, certainly because of all the other limitations that go along with it.
Now, just very quickly, as a consumer yourself, does it surprise you that this has been announced in parallel with Cyber Monday?
Of course not. Oh, I'm so jealous that I didn't think about it first and make my own announcement. But I think it's it was perfect timing.
Professor Mary Cummings. Now, in northern Nigeria, scores of military personnel and civilians are believed to have died in an attack on an army and air force base by gunmen linked to extremist Boko Haram group. The attack is one of the first on formal military installations in the country, as the Al-Qaeda-linked group has attacked and killed mostly rural villagers over the past 6 months. FSN's correspondent Malcolm Brown spoke earlier with Gary Alfonso, who's in northeast Nigeria, and began by asking him about the latest attack by the extremist group.
Well, news in over the past few hours is that a suspected Boko Haram rebels group launched a massive attack on a Nigerian Air Force base in Borno State. That's in the northeast of Nigeria in the past 24 hours. And many people were killed, and also forcing the government to put a very extreme clampdown and curfew on the area for the next 24 to 48 hours. And the attack occurred in the early hours of the day when insurgents invaded a very sleepy city of Maiduguri and launched a coordinated strike on a combined military and air force base. And it looks like an adjoining trailer park in the city was also a victim to that attack. And a police source says that scores of people, including military personnel, may have been killed. There are no official numbers yet. But the scene has been described as extremely bloody by civilian and army sources. And a military spokesman confirmed the attack, but also claimed it was repelled. He said that Boko Haram insurgents attacked, but were successfully repelled, and also saying that the attackers suffered serious losses while fleeing. And this, of course, has been the pattern over the past few weeks, where Boko Haram has killed more than 200 people in the past 3 months, indiscriminately attacking Islamic and Christian villages at will. And so this latest attack really has been seen as very bold by these attackers, and basically pushing back what they see as very severe forms of government clampdowns in trying to force them out of rural areas.
Is this attack being seen as an escalation, in the sense that it did not target seemingly a civilian target, but in fact very much a military target? Is it being seen in Nigeria as an escalation, therefore?
Well, yes, it certainly is a different feel and also a different modus operandi in this attack, in that the military bases is for the first time that an attack on a military or an official police or security institution has taken place. All other attacks have previously been against villagers and small groups of people at roadblocks, at impromptu roadblocks set up by these extremists. So this is a first in as far as attacking security forces directly is concerned.
And how widely is the impact of Boko Haram being felt in Nigeria? You've said that these attacks occur mostly in the north, but is the impact being felt right around the country?
Well, yes, the psychological effect of these attacks is something I can mention. But as far as the situation of these attacks is, mostly in the three north and northeastern states in Nigeria, where it's most serious, where curfews and a state of emergency remains in place. And it's at its worst in Borno State, where the most recent attacks happened. And it's also where Nigerian security forces have been deployed in serious numbers, and where attacks against Boko Haram insurgents have reaped the most success. And these Boko Haram attackers are in most cases in small groups of armed vigilantes who prey on small villages and attack small rural communities with great levels of brutality before then disappearing into the thick bush or rugged landscape. And in many cases, the Nigerian security forces believe they disappear across the border into Niger or even Chad or northern Cameroon, where they can obviously not be pursued.
Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Tuesday, Syria's chemical weapons stash is back in focus. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.